Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. For all of its wonders and utility, digital technology can also be very destructive. It can undermine some pretty fundamental things, like honesty and, ultimately, learning. How that's playing out in our schools and colleges is Cynthia Reeser's focus in this latest interview in her series on public education in Kentucky.
Cheating has been around as long as students have been doing school assignments, but like everything else in the world, technology has changed cheating. So we're talking to Jamie Schaefer today, and she is EKU's Coordinator of Teaching and Learning Initiatives. And that is a part of the Knowles Studio for Creativity, which provides academic resources for students and faculty. Jamie conducts and organizes professional development for EKU professors to help keep them up to date on the best and latest teaching practices for the college classroom, both live and virtual. So, Ms. Schaefer, what are some of the most popular online cheating apps that you know about, and how are they used?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me on to talk about this. I know it is a topic that many folks are wondering and that's certainly been on our minds during the pandemic. So there are a lot of websites and apps that we commonly call cheating apps. By far, the one that's probably the most well-known and widely used is Chegg. And there's a number of others out there that function in different ways. PhotoMath, Socratic, which is a Google program, Course Hero, Slater. Those are some of the more popular ones. They're used in different ways. Each one has its own method of use and pay structures. So for instance, with PhotoMath, you simply download an app, take a picture of a math problem and send it to them, and they will send back step-by-step instructions as well as the answer to the problem. Their basic level is free, or you can choose a paid upgrade. Chegg allows you to search common answers for free, or you can buy a subscription, $15 a month, to have experts answer your specific question. And, you know, there's things like Paper Coach, which will write papers for you at $8 a page. These apps can be used in any field, although we hear about them most often, probably most commonly used in math or science courses. That is probably a function of the fact that there's often a correct answer as well as a method for getting there that you may not have in other disciplines. A lot of folks will see this as sort of a new age version of writing answers on the back of your hand or buying essays from classmates or things that have been around for a long time. One important point to note is that these websites do not bill themselves as cheating apps, as you might imagine. You'll hear them called helpers, writing services, homework solutions, things like that. You know, I was a child of the 80s, and I remember Homework Hotline. I know this is different from Homework Hotline. You know, I think somewhere we cross maybe a line from tutoring or helping a student with homework to doing it for them. And that is something that's problematic because we do learn so well as humans from doing things.
Who's at the other end of the computer doing these math problems?
That's a great question. They get their folks from a number of different sources. So you can actually search job postings if you're looking for ways to help people with homework that will pay a certain hourly rate. And so they will have students, advanced students a lot of times, PhD students, subject experts, anybody who might be looking to make a little extra money that has expertise in an area can sign up to work for one of these organizations and submit answers.
Wow. How common is cheating using these online tools in virtual classes or online classes?
I think it's important to remember that cheating has always been around. Prior to the pandemic, I would say that they were actually similar rates for in-person and online classes. High-end estimates that some studies have found that as high as 95% of high schoolers and 70% of college students will admit to cheating in some way. That may be on a test, that may be plagiarism, that may be copying homework, that can be a number of different methods. But as online education has ballooned during the pandemic, the use of these online tools has also ballooned. So a recent study found that the number of questions that were submitted to Chegg in STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, and math, has jumped almost 200% since the pandemic started, and Chegg subscriptions have grown by 69%. So I would say that it is on the rise with online education. Part of this is because it's obviously a little harder to catch cheating online. That has led to some of the proctoring services where you have to take tests in front of cameras, programs that will lock down browsers so that you can't go look up an answer while you're taking a test. It can kind of become a perpetual mouse hunt in some ways, trying to catch people who are doing this. But, you know, overall, that sounds a little negative. I don't want it to be negative. I think that the basic reasons why students cheat haven't changed all that much. And if we can address the why, then we can still combat some of those concerns.
Well, why do students cheat?
That is a great question. It's important to realize that students don't cheat because they're bad students or bad people, or that they're ignorant and don't realize it's wrong. What we know is that most students know that cheating is wrong, and they choose not to do it if they see another choice. So some of the most common things that lead to cheating, first of all, when students are feeling a lot of stress or pressure to perform, sometimes cheating can seem like the easier option when it feels like you may not get to that point that you need to succeed. If they're in an environment where they're having more emphasis placed on a grade rather than the learning, and that can be by anyone in their life, that can be by, you know, educators, that can be by parents, that can be by siblings, but anyone who feels that they're having more emphasis placed on performance and scoring rather than the learning that occurs, that is sort of ripe for that to occur. If they feel that it's easy to kind of rationalize why they cheated, like everybody's cheating, I'll be at a disadvantage if I don't. And then if they see the opportunity and think that there's not consequences, those are things that lend themselves to cheating as a general rule.
Well, of course, parents and faculty, two different groups, but what recommendations might you have for parents or faculty to help discourage students or their children from using these easy-to-use and easy-to-access apps?
I think that it is challenging. I think that the biggest thing that teachers in particular can do in a classroom setting is to take away incentives to cheat. So like I mentioned, if students are feeling the stress, feeling this pressure, feeling the pressure to get a certain grade, that is going to make them more likely to engage in this behavior. So teachers can do things like relying more on low-stakes assignments, group projects, reading responses, discussion boards, rather than, you know, that midterm exam where, you know, 50% of your grade depends on the next hour in class. Allowing revisions on papers, quizzes, allowing students to do things over encourages learning, considering flexible deadlines, taking into account what's going on in their lives. Those sorts of things can help reduce the pressure. I think that doing what you can to remind students of the importance of learning, how it is going to benefit them going forward into other classes, going forward into the quote-unquote real world, into work, to actually learn the material that they're covering in the class. One way that's really effective can be to put expectations in a syllabus or in course materials right up front. So one sort of statement that I like is, you know, as part of XYZ community, the EKU Kernel community, we believe in honor and integrity. Online homework apps such as Chegg or similar apps are not permitted. Mm-hmm. The expectation is that you will ask the instructor prior to using these. That sort of outlines the expectations up front, so there's no ambiguity where a student can say, oh, I didn't see this as cheating.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a few, you know, kind of simpler, small changes that people can make in testing environments, using different tests for different sections, avoid reusing exams. These sorts of things make it a little bit more difficult for students to engage in that behavior. Now, on the parent side, I would say some of those things are similar. I think, you know, reducing that pressure can be really vital for parents as well. And taking the time to talk to students about why they might be cheating or why they feel the pressure to cheat. Are they stressed? Are they feeling like they're falling behind their peers? Are they not understanding the material? Understanding why your student might be participating in that behavior can kind of help parents work with them and figure out a better way for them to approach that. Keeping involved in your student's education, knowing what type of homework they're being given, being aware of what apps they're using to help them with that homework. If, as a parent, you're permitting those apps to be used, that's certainly up to you, but keep an eye on how they're using it. Mm-hmm. And if you do catch them using it for what you would consider cheating, make sure that they know that you're firmly against that and that there may be consequences both at home and at school for some of their actions. And then finally, I would say, you know, teaching students at all ages that failure is not a bad thing. We learn a lot from failing. We can take those lessons and do better next time. And that's a lesson that sometimes is lost. And when there's no room for that failure, I think that it puts students in this situation where they feel like they may not have a choice but to engage in some cheating activities.
You know, you mentioned earlier that cheating's always been around, and I think everyone knows that, even before the computer and the internet. But in the big picture, what are some of the wider implications for society when students cheat on their assignments?
Yeah, I think that is a great question, and I will attempt to stay off of my soapbox on this topic. I think there's a number of different concerns. You know, I think, first of all, if you look at sort of the model that some of those companies are using, you're claiming to provide one thing. You may even have policies supporting that. But in practice, you're delivering something that is entirely different and that might be ethically questionable in some ways. At the same time, you have those tutors, you have PhD students, you have subject experts who are all making money from this, contributing to the economy, et cetera, et cetera. That's a whole nest of issues to explore. If that's a profitable model, then that may open doors for the use of technology in education that brings up some questions as far as how it should be used and when it should be used. You know, I think secondly, as far as education in general, the internet itself has really become our source of all knowledge. You know, Googling something is the expectation. So, you know, one of the concerns that arises from that is, you know, in recent years, we've heard about, do we need to have handwriting because everybody uses keyboards? Do we need to teach basic math skills because everybody always has access to calculators? And so, you know, my kind of natural question would be, what is the role of educators if you're living in a world where you can get any knowledge, any answers, anything by just snapping a picture of your problem and sending it in? Mm-hmm. And how does this affect critical thinking? So, you know, in our world today, it's never been more important to discern what's real and what's not real and to form our own thoughts and our own opinions about the world around us. And critical thinking is such an important piece of that. And that's something that we get from, you know, struggling through these answers and learning the material as we're going through it. And then, you know, finally, I think maybe the more obvious answer is the purpose of schools and education is to prepare our students for whatever may come next, whether that's further education, whether that's careers. And so when they're using these sites that are kind of taking the place of some of that, does that enable them to be successful going forward in advanced coursework, in graduate school, or in the workplace? And so having graduates that have these solid foundations out there, you know, working in Kentucky, serving the Commonwealth, we don't survive without that. So it becomes even more important when you look at it from that level.
It does. And you mentioned that people often think, oh, if I don't know the answer, I can just search for it on the internet. But
yes.
you know, you conduct a search on Google and you get a page of answers and the first 10 pages might be wrong or misleading. So just having information doesn't mean you can understand and evaluate the information.
Absolutely. And, you know, definite shout out. I know that you've done a lot of work, Cynthia, with media literacy and being able to decipher what is accurate, what is, you know, something that we should be paying attention to from that huge list of Google searches.
Right. That is, it is close to my heart. It's like you have to understand what's good information and what's junk or someone trying to persuade you or sell you something.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I couldn't agree more with that.
Well, thank you so much. I think you've really made people think about the tools that are out there and how they could be used appropriately and inappropriately. And again, just because it's on the internet doesn't mean it's true.
Absolutely. That's some great words of wisdom, I would say.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
What if forgiving student debt could benefit hundreds of thousands of Kentuckians and improve racial equity in our state? A new analysis from the Kentucky Center for Economic Policy indicates debt forgiveness could do just that. And here to give us details is the center's research director, Ashley Spalding. Welcome back to Eastern Standard, Ashley.
Great. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So first, to get a handle on the scope of the student loan landscape in Kentucky, how many Kentuckians are currently shouldering this kind of debt?
Well, in terms of federal student loans, which make up about 90% of outstanding student loan balances, around 616,000 Kentuckians have student debt, and that's about 18% of Kentuckians over the age of 18. So that is a very large number of Kentuckians when we're looking at the potential for student loan forgiveness to impact our state.
And what kind of debt are we looking at? What's the amount of the typical outstanding student loan balance?
The average, if we were talking about 616,000 Kentuckians and how much federal debt we have in our state, that's roughly $33,300 per borrower. And the median amount then is $18,000. And so when we're talking about these numbers, it's important to keep in mind that these amounts, whether they sound big or not, that we know that they are unaffordable for so many Kentuckians. And so one part of our analysis, for instance, looks at, in terms of people who've been in college recently in Kentucky, whether or not they earned a degree or credential before they left. So some of these folks, that median $18,000, these are people that haven't necessarily earned a degree or credential even. So I guess I just want to point out that, some people might say, oh, $18,000 for a college degree, that's a reasonable amount. But when we're looking at how much people end up making when they're leaving, whether or not they even earned a degree, and a lot of other things that we do know, this amount is holding a lot of people back. They're unable to repay it or to make good progress on paying it down.
Are there a lot of people in that category who were pursuing a degree and then had to drop out because they had to work, they had to hold down a couple of jobs and just couldn't do it?
There sure are. One part of our paper, one part of our analysis, looks at a data set of recent Kentucky public university and community college students. And, the total number of students represented here, these are 223,457 students who started college in 2012 or later, were not enrolled during 2019, and then worked in Kentucky during 2019 and 2020, and didn't go to a private college at all. So that's a lot of detail, but this is a specific data set where we were able to look at these recent college graduates and parse out some patterns. And what we found is that, more than half had student loans. Of these students, 64% left without earning a credential or a degree, and 49% of those students took out federal loans. And, the data set doesn't have information specific to why they left, if they didn't earn a degree or credential, but a broader body of research does show that often it is for financial reasons that individuals aren't able to stay in school to complete a degree, at least at this time. When we're looking at the implications of student loan forgiveness, one piece of it is that those individuals may be able to afford to actually complete their degrees.
In your analysis,
Do you also take a look at racial and ethnic disparities in the student loan picture?
Yes. Again, with that data set that we looked at, where we're looking specifically at these recent public university and community college students, we did find that Black students were more likely than students from other racial or ethnic groups to take out student loans. And of course, that has a lot to do with the economic barriers, the historic structural inequities that exist for Black Kentuckians, to where tuition and fees end up being a larger share of their incomes, and there are a lot of other barriers to enrolling in college in some cases and being, you know, successfully completing a degree. And so these Black Kentucky students are more likely to take out loans. And that is in line with the broader national picture, where there's been a lot of focus on racial equity and the implications of student loan forgiveness for racial equity. Although with Black Kentucky students, looking at this data set, they did not take on higher amounts of debt than students from other groups, which is a little different from the national picture. So when we're looking at this, it's really an issue where Black students are really harmed more by this student debt crisis, that there's disproportionate harm to Black student borrowers. And then so student loan forgiveness has the potential to address some of these racial inequities. And there have been recent analyses put out at the national level that show that student debt is actually contributing to a growing racial wealth gap. And so student loan forgiveness could help to stop that growth and potentially make steps toward decreasing it. And the research shows that the greater the debt forgiveness, for instance, the $50,000 versus the $10,000, the greater the implications for race equity. Also, in our data set for the recent college students, is that Black students were more likely than students from other racial or ethnic groups to have incomes under $30,000. And so that shows that these students have even more difficulty paying back the loan. So that speaks to the these bigger issues of economic inequalities.
Well, since we are talking about debt burden, it's maybe obvious why relieving it would be beneficial for a lot of people. But how about the economy on the whole? How would it benefit the economy?
For people who owe student loans, who are in repayment, that's typically hundreds of $1,000s a month that they may be expected to pay toward their loans. In a lot of cases, they just end up paying the interest, and very little even goes to the balance. So this just is a big weight on people's shoulders. But these hundreds of dollars a month could be invested into home ownership, into people being able to, like I mentioned, afford to go back to college and actually complete a degree, could allow them to get more reliable transportation to get to a better job. So these are dollars that are tied up in student debt that could be invested in these different ways and would circulate in the economy. So there would be significant implications for the economy. And we know, you know, right now, because of provisions in the CARES Act, that individuals with student debt are able to not make those payments on their loans right now. And that'll go through it at least the fall. And that has been a big benefit to individuals, but also has had economic impacts as well.
Kind of kicks the can down the road, right? I mean, are those deferred payments? They're not accruing, are they?
Right, they're not accruing. So it's been beneficial, but as you mentioned, it is not a long-term solution. On the other hand, that student loan forgiveness is a big step toward addressing some of these issues. It certainly much more needs to be done to address the racial wealth gap. Much more needs to be done to address college affordability issues and student debt issues. But these student loan forgiveness proposals that are being considered do have really significant implications.
All right. Kentucky Center for Economic Policy Research Director, Dr. Ashley Spaulding. Thank you, Ashley.
Thank you so much.
Coming up after the break, our series State of Justice looks at police violence in Black communities. We'll hear about a complicating factor in making the decision to get the COVID vaccine among people with type 2 diabetes and guidance for communities developing their own strategies to deal with climate change. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
This is Wendy Barnett with the Undermain Arts Minute, bringing you local and regional arts news and events. The Lexington Philharmonic and Lexington hip-hop artist and activist Divine Karama are teaming up to present Beat of the Heartland, a free collaborative performance with Karama and a string quintet from the Lex Phil. The concert will be on Saturday, June 12th at 7 p.m. at the Loudon House in Lexington. The concert will be preceded on the afternoon of June 12th by a community festival on the grounds of the Loudon House featuring local vendors and community organizations. The festival is produced in a partnership between the Lex Phil and the Lexington Art League. More information is available at lexville.org/events. You can find more in-depth writing about Kentucky arts online at undermain.art. This has been the Undermain Arts Minute for WEKU's Eastern Standard.
In the summer of 2020, protests swept the nation and the world in response to the police killings of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. And organizing in response to ongoing police violence in Black communities has once again swept the nation this spring as high-profile police killings continue to command national attention. It's Ray Geringer's focus in this latest in our State of Justice series.
In addition to ongoing protests in Kentucky demanding justice for Breonna Taylor, who was shot and killed by Louisville police officers when they raided her apartment in March 2020, organizers are pushing for statewide policy changes to increase police accountability measures. Keturah Heron is a policy strategist at the ACLU of Kentucky, and after learning about the no-knock search warrant that Louisville officers used to enter Taylor's apartment, she drafted an ordinance that she hoped the city would adopt to ban the warrants outright. The city of Louisville did ban no-knock warrants, and Heron and other organizers then turned their focus to the state legislature.
Breonna's Law is actually a law that was birthed out of Louisville, Kentucky, when there was the murder of Breonna Taylor. There was a group of us who mobilized and got activated to make sure that we put a ban on no-knock warrants. And so we were able to pass that in Louisville locally and do a complete ban on no-knock warrants in the city of Louisville. And so what the statewide version of Breonna looks like, for one, Representative Attica Scott has filed House Bill 21, and pretty much it's an act to ban no-knock warrants.
HB 21 did not successfully pass through the Kentucky legislature. In early April 2021, Governor Andy Beshear signed HB 4, a partial ban on no-knock warrants across the state. But Representative Attica Scott, who filed HB 21, said that HB 4 is not Breonna's law. That's in part because HB 4, which Beshear signed, did not ban no-knock warrants entirely and allows them in certain situations. And it doesn't include mandated alcohol and drug testing of officers involved in deadly shootings, or that they be interviewed within 2 hours of an incident where they fire their weapons, whether or not it caused a fatality. And Keturah Heron says that Breonna's law was an obvious first step, but it's by no means the end of needed reforms in Kentucky.
To me, the biggest issue is that when are we going to get to legislation that actually holds police accountable? And I think that that's what we've seen throughout, not just in the case of Breonna Taylor, but in policing in general. It's very difficult to hold a police accountable for misconduct. And I think at the end of the day, we need to pass Breonna's law. However, I also think that we need to get to legislation that actually looks at police accountability and making sure that when police officers are deemed to be disruptive and are deemed, as some people say, bad apples, that we're able to get rid of them and no longer allow them to police communities. You know, I know that this bill has created, you know, a lot of conversation and some controversy, but I think at the end of the day, to me, this bill is about the preservation of human life. I just don't know how we as a society can say that people have a right to protect their home, but then also say that police have a right to come in your home unannounced. Like, those two things do not match up. Because if you say I can protect my home, I am going to protect my home. And if you tell police they can come in, police are going to come in. And so something has got to give on that. And I don't think that people who are gun advocates are going to back down and say that we're not allowed to protect our home.
We also asked Haren about any differences she's seen between policing in rural communities versus urban communities across Kentucky.
I'm from Richmond, Kentucky. And so I think that the same policing policies that I saw in my community growing up are the same things that we see in Louisville. And so one of the things that you hear people talk about is that because it is a small community, people's cars are easily identified. And so if someone has had a previous arrest, it's easy for police to see them driving down the street and just pull them over because they know them. I know that those things happen in rural communities. I mean, no doubt in my mind, I've seen it. And so I think that some of those same tactics that we see in urban communities, as far as certain communities being policed or certain people being pulled over because of their car or because tint is too dark, we see that in rural communities. And so I think that it would be interesting to, you know, to do some type of study or storytelling of the juxtapose of what happens in these urban communities and what happens in rural communities.
We set out to do just that, trying to find folks in rural Eastern Kentucky who had experienced police violence and aggression. And while multiple individuals spoke to us of their experiences off the record, none of them felt safe going on the record for an interview to talk about these interactions. The reality in small towns is often that everyone knows everyone. And many people who have had negative experiences with police expressed concern that talking about that on the record would put them or their family members at increased risk for additional police violence or aggression. According to researchers at Harvard University and Northeastern University, between 2015 and 2017, the rate of fatal police shootings in rural parts of the country were almost the same as in cities. But studies show that across the nation, Black people are much more likely to be killed by police than white people. The Mapping Violence Project found that in Kentucky, Black people were 2.3 times as likely to be killed by police as white people. In 2015, the Washington Post began to log fatal shootings by on-duty police officers across the United States. Since then, they've logged more than 5,000 such shootings, including 111 in Kentucky. So far, between January and late April of 2021, they've documented 984 fatal police shootings. But in addition to fatal police shootings, oppressive patterns of over-policing are a concern to criminal justice reform advocates nationwide. Cynthia Allison works for the Department of Public Advocacy in Harlan, Kentucky, which is the public defender system for the state. And in her interview, she shared her own opinions, not those of the department. She says that in addition to racial profiling by police in rural Eastern Kentucky counties, poor white people sometimes also experience increased police scrutiny.
Treating people differently happens definitely with class. You know, kind of class takes the place of racism in the absence of diversity. You know, I tell the story of my husband. He is a distracted driver, and he was driving late, and he turned into this road. There's almost never any cars on that road. It's the road to his mom's house. It's a driveway and a road, and he just plowed into these people and wrecked. And so he called the cops, and he was like, I just hit a car. You know, we need some assistance. And when the cop gets there, he tells them it was his fault, owned it. And they didn't drug test him. They didn't do any field sobriety tests. And totally got the people out of the victims, the people who were hit, got them out of the car, looked through their car, right? Just because they were, you know, they looked the part of people who might use drugs. They weren't dressed appropriately for the weather. They were tatted up. Their car was beat up. But the police basically harassed them instead of the person who was responsible.
As national conversations and calls for police reform and abolition continue, the enmeshed nature of rural communities brings specific challenges to calling out police harm. And across the state of Kentucky, from Louisville to Harlan, organizers say that the work is far from over. For WEKU, I'm Ray Geringer.
State of Justice, a series exploring issues related to the criminal justice system in Eastern Kentucky, is being provided to Eastern Standard by Ray Geringer and Amelia Kirby with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and a grant from the Vera Institute of Justice. Public health officials are worried that a hesitancy among a significant number of people to get the COVID vaccine will, in the end, undermine movement toward light at the end of the pandemic tunnel. And as Parker Hobson reports from Whitesburg, there is particular concern about people who have type 2 diabetes.
As a volunteer firefighter for Jeannie Wheeler of Johnson County, her job was stressful enough already before the pandemic hit.
It's not always a fire that we respond to, but accidents, medical emergencies, all those kinds of things. So, you know, you may be up close and personal in a lot of situations. So it's been a little difficult here in the last year or so.
Jeannie is also a retired nurse. And being in regular close contact with strangers as a firefighter, she says it's been hard sometimes not to think about the coronavirus.
Yeah, it's always in the back of my mind. It's like, you know, I have medical issues myself. I have elderly parents who have medical issues. I have grandchildren that are around me occasionally. So it worries me that, you know, I might expose myself to something that I don't want for sure, and I sure don't want to take into anybody else.
And while a lot of us have been nervous about getting the virus, for Jeannie, the stakes are a little different. She has type 2 diabetes, and while she says she keeps healthy and manages her blood sugar well, health professionals say that type 2 is one of several conditions, like COPD or black lung disease or heart disease, that could make the symptoms of COVID-19 worse if you were to happen to get it. So when she became eligible for a vaccine, Jeannie says she didn't hesitate.
Well, given my current medical state, I had to make a decision on whether do you take a chance on getting it, because you know with your diabetes that, you know, in all likelihood, if it's a bad case, you're not going to make it through, or do you go ahead and take a chance on taking the vaccine? And I had no issues with deciding that the vaccine was the way to go. And for me, you know, I was always for vaccinations for my children. And my daughter's a frontline worker. She had her vaccines. My parents have had theirs, and they're like 85 and 89 years old. And they did exceptionally well. They had no side effects whatsoever from either dose. You know, it's not a local thing. It's a major worldwide issue. And, you know, all the other countries are in the same position that we are. So we just have to take a chance.
We do know that people with diabetes are more likely to have more serious complications from COVID-19.
Denisa Watts is a registered nurse and a licensed diabetes educator with the Kentucky River District Health Department in Knott County.
So we really encourage people, you know, with diabetes to talk to their physicians and to, you know, consider having that COVID vaccine. And also, we know that the risk of getting sick from COVID-19 it's likely to be lower if their diabetes is well managed. So we know right now it is a very stressful time, and lots of times when we're stressed, we kind of get lax in doing some of those important things, you know, our healthy eating, our physical activity. But it's more important now than ever to try to keep, you know, those blood sugars in control and try to keep their diabetes well managed.
Denisa says she got her vaccine literally as soon as she could.
Absolutely. The first day it was available for me, and I'll never forget, it was an emotional day too, you know, because just thinking what, you know, the changes in our lives over that past year, and to think about, you know, this vaccine, how wonderful it was, you know, that step in getting back to some normalcy in our lives.
While Denisa knows some people might have questions about the vaccine, she says people should know that their doctors and nurses and health professionals are getting vaccinated themselves. Denisa herself has even been helping to give out COVID vaccines on top of her diabetes work.
In the local health departments, we had long waiting lists when the vaccine came out, folks wanting, you know, to get their name down. I think most healthcare providers really feel strongly that the advantage of taking the vaccine greatly outweighs, you know, the possible risk from the vaccine, which, you know, there are other folks who have more side effects, but from what I'm seeing as a provider, the majority of the time it's just, you know, a little sore arm. And most of those side effects we do see have been going away, you know, in 24, 36 hours. It doesn't last long in general.
With my vaccine, the first one, my arm was a little sore.
Here again is Jeannie Wheeler of Johnson County.
The day afterward, I was a little sluggish, you know, but nothing really drastic at all. And with the second one, my arm got pretty sore that time. The next day, I just wanted to kind of lay around the house and didn't really feel like eating much that day or anything. But, I mean, there was no side effects that weren't really any major issues.
Speaking of side effects, you might have heard that the FDA recently lifted a temporary pause on the one-dose Johnson & Johnson vaccine. According to the FDA, the pause was because of a rare but serious blood clotting issue in the days following the shot. This side effect has been incredibly rare, though. So far, it's affected just about 2 out of every 1 million people who have gotten the Johnson & Johnson shot. And health experts say the pause was a sign the system is working like it should, to help medical providers best look out for people who might end up with these rare side effects. Here in Kentucky, the vast majority of vaccines given out have been from Pfizer or Moderna, and there have been no reports of a similar issue with them. For her part, Denisa says she believes in the public health systems that test and regulate our vaccines.
I've been a public health nurse for 33 years. I've always been an advocate of all of our vaccines. I spent many years vaccinating babies, young children, with some of the Tdap vaccines, the measles, mumps, rubella, chickenpox. So we just really encourage people, those not only with diabetes, but anyone, to look at those possible risk if they actually did contract the COVID-19 virus and kind of, you know, weigh the risk with the vaccine. It's not something that has been looked at lightly, and it's been tested, trials. So, you know, we feel that it is a safe vaccine.
You know, with the fire department, we have a lot of EMTs and we have career firefighters as well as the volunteers and stuff. And they have all been more than willing to take the vaccine and to protect themselves, you know. So, I mean, it's not like anybody is forcing you to do that, but it's just a personal decision that you have to make yourself. I'm a very devout Christian, and I just, you know, the Lord has got it in his hands, and whichever way it works out, you know, is the way it's going to be. But I see no reason to take chances that you don't have to take. So therefore, the vaccine was my choice.
All Kentuckians age 16 and up are now eligible for a COVID vaccine. For more about the vaccine or how to find it near you, talk to your doctor, call your county health department, or visit vaccine.ky.gov. Reporting for Eastern Standard from Apple Shops WMMT, I'm Parker Hobson.
can learn more online at PreventDiabetesKY, that's one word, PreventDiabetesKY.org. As a community development specialist at the Community and Economic Development Initiative of Kentucky, based at UK, Dan Call works with cities and towns to help them come up with strategies to deal with the realities of a changing climate, flooding, or its opposite extreme, drought, for example. Dan, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thanks, Tom. I'm glad to be here.
And let's begin with a contribution you made, a chapter, to the book Addressing Climate Change at the Community Level in the United States. It looks at how citizens are thinking about climate. Tell us about your findings.
A colleague and I, Dr. Campbell at Kansas State University, wrote a chapter on engaging citizens to address community climate change issues. And what we found, actually, this was based on some research in the state of Kansas. And we had done a series of 16 different focus groups with different interests, including agricultural producers, community leaders, and educators, as well as some deliberative dialogue events that brought nearly 100 people together to talk about climate issues. And we were really trying to discern how people understood and talked about climate change and get a better understanding of kind of where to begin in terms of responding to this huge issue. What we found was that what tended to work best was not to ask them about climate change right out. And what I mean by that is that when our conversations began with asking them what changes they've noticed in the climate, in the growing seasons, in their communities, and how those changes have affected them, that was an effective starting point to really begin these conversations about an issue that often is overwhelmingly complicated and seems challenging to address.
Well, Dan, I'm really curious about the kind of reception that you receive when you sit down with community leaders, let's say, to talk about climate change. Is there skepticism or acceptance that it's a real thing that they need to pay attention to?
That's mixed. But I would say that what I find is that the concept of climate, again, is almost beyond what a lot of the community leaders feel that they need to address. If they're elected officials or appointed in government, their scope is less than trying to, you know, solve the world's problems. And they tend to be a lot more immediate and kind of localized. So typically when I get a call to work with communities, they have a local strategic plan, or they have flooding issues, or they have sewer and water issues, or there are key ways that we can look at some of the issues that they're currently addressing and think about it in terms of how do we respond to it in a way that will help the community be more resilient and actually have a larger impact down the road.
So you go into a town that's experiencing more frequent flooding, let's say, in these times of more extreme weather, and they want to know what they can do to mitigate that. And you bring the resources to them, do you, to figure that out?
Yes. I bring an opportunity to start a conversation and start to explore what it means to that community, and then to have some conversations about what are the alternatives available to us and how would we go about working to access those.
Well, in a community, who is impacted most by climate change?
That's a really insightful question, because back to that research that we did, mm-hmm. the chapter referenced earlier, as well as my experience in communities now, not everyone experiences the implications of climate change equally. People in communities that are impacted by this are those that aren't as mobile. They don't have the resources to just move. There are people that maybe don't have as good of insulation in their homes, air conditioning in their homes. It includes people that are locationally, depending on where you are in the community, you may be in a floodplain. And so the implications of the changing climate are very real to you and your household, whereas others that are out of that floodplain may not see it as important directly or as immediate to them. But the research has shown that people on the spectrum of age, both young and old, are more affected by changes in climate. And those with health issues, including asthma or allergies, are also more vulnerable. So as you ask that question, you find that there are a variety of answers of people that are impacted in differing ways, even within a community.
Well, Dan, how can an interested city or town official who's looking at climate change and saying, you know, this is real, we need to get it together here, how can they get in touch with you to start the process?
I am with CEDIC, the Community and Economic Development Initiative of Kentucky, and that is at the University of Kentucky. But I'm also a part of a collective group called the Kentucky Climate Change Consortium. And that's a group of folks from universities and cities across Kentucky that are organizing resources and sharing expertise to work toward better change. So with my contact information at the University of Kentucky through CEDIC, I can access that network. But I will say that there are some great tools out there, Tom, that communities can be looking at. And of course, each of those, it depends on the area and priority of the community, but things like energy usage, the Kentucky Utilities is doing a really nice job right now of exploring and expanding renewable energy opportunities. The Kentucky Transportation Cabinet has resources for bikeability and walkability for those communities that are wanting to reduce or alter the patterns of transportation or making their communities more walkable. Kentucky Energy and Environment Cabinet has the Basin Advisory Council coordinators that are working in watershed basins across the state to better manage water resources, both with runoff as well as the impact of flooding. And so there are some great resources around the state that, yes, in my role in working with communities, I try to find good resources and good connections to address the issues that communities are wrestling with.
Well, hopefully somebody listening out there will be in touch with you and they can take advantage of that. This is Dan Call, a community development specialist at the Community and Economic Development Initiative of Kentucky, based at UK, and he's with the Kentucky Climate Change Consortium. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you, Tom.
That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Mike Savage is our executive producer, Wendy Barnett, our producer, Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard on air, online, and on mobile at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Want to suggest an interview or a topic? You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.